Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. The Eco Leadership Institute is running Reenchantment Trilogy. These are three events. The first event is starting in November. It's a three-day face-to-face event in a spiritual center near Barcelona. The theme is Soul at Work. We're going to create a small faith community and explore our spirituality and how we bring our souls to work. It should be a very beautiful event. We're going to run that, and then next year we're going to run two other events, one on the ecology and the environment, how we work and live in our ecosystems, and then the third will be creativity in the city. So if you're interested in our first event, Soul at Work, get in touch with me at the Eco Leadership Institute. It's 8th, 9th, 10th of November in a small town, Reus, near Barcelona. Look forward to seeing you there. Welcome, everybody, to this edition of Edgy Ideas Podcast. Today, my very special guest is Gabriella Braun. Gabriella is a director of Working Well, a consultancy firm using psychoanalytic and systemic thinking to help leaders and teams. She has consulted to numerous clients, including the British Library, Tate Galleries, NHS Trust, schools and universities. Gabriella holds a master's degree in consulting to organizations, psychoanalytic approaches, and she was a principal consultant at the Tavistock Consultancy Service. Gab is also a successful author, and her recent book, All That We Are, Uncovering Hidden Truths About Our Behavior at Work, is doing very well. And I want to talk to you, Gabby, about your book and your work. How are you today?
I'm well, and it's lovely to be here. Thank you for having me, Simon.
Very nice to see you. Just to let the audience know that we've crossed paths for a good number of years.
We have,
so that's good. So tell me, or tell the audience about the book. What inspired you to write it, Gabriella?
I was inspired by, I think, two things, really. One, that I feel that psychoanalytic and systems thinking has so much to offer the workplace, but those of us in the field have traditionally been, and I include myself in that, really poor at bringing it to the mainstream. I think there has been a bit of a view that people needed to come and find us rather than we really went, and we paid lip service to going out and finding them, but I'm not sure we really took it very seriously. So that was one reason for writing a book that, well, it's both reasons. That was the reason that I thought psychoanalytic systemic thinking needed to get out there and get out there more widely. So I wanted to write it, and I wanted to write it with a mainstream publisher, not a academic or a psychoanalytic publisher.
Yeah. I mean, you're right that I think psychoanalysis has long been elitist. And there's been a need to democratize it for many years. And the language of it can be off-putting as well. It can be, I think two things are off-putting to people. One is people kind of see Freud as something of an old patriarch, and some of his views are contentious. And people don't realize how much psychoanalysis has moved on and moved beyond that. So I think that's one thing. And two, the other thing, the language can be off-putting. So I was delighted to see the book, and I read David Armstrong's review, and he talks about your passion for the work. I think that really shines through in the book, which is mm-hmm. lovely. And I think both you and I share that passion, actually.
Yes. And I agree with you about people's thinking about Freud and also the language being problematic for many people, and you know, it's real jargon unless you're in the field. But also, yeah. Not only do people not know how much it's moved on since Freud, I think Freud is under in terms of how he moved his own thinking on all the time. He was constantly evolving his thinking. And I think that isn't really recognised very much.
No, I agree. And it's true of most of the great thinkers in psychoanalysis, actually. Bion was the same.
Yeah.
Jacques Lacan was the same. They all kind of started off on a journey of discovery, and they were never static in their opinions. It was always kind of making sense of the world as they went and through discovery and through their client work.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I often think how delighted Freud would be to sort of examine society today and see all the things happening. He'd be into neuroscience. He'd be into everything. He'd be kind of all over it.
Definitely. Yeah.
Do you want to share some of the key themes in your work and in the book? I mean, we bring psychoanalysis to the workplace and we bring systemic thinking to the workplace. What does that mean for you, Gabriella?
What it means for me is that I think about and look at and feel in myself the things that we can't consciously get at and aren't being spoken about. They're kind of under the carpet somewhere. And so that's the psychoanalytic thing. I'm very aware of what else is going on. And
yes.
I think that probably, hopefully, comes out in the stories that I've written in the book, that I'm using myself as an instrument, which is a typical technique of psychoanalysis, that the analyst uses themselves as an instrument. And, you know, it sounds weird, but I think we can all get better at actually paying attention to what we're feeling rather than dismissing that and trying to go past it. So that's something I do. I think with the and there are, of course, typical things in psychoanalysis that have become mainstream now, like people talk and take as an absolute given sibling rivalry in the family, but not in the workplace. And of course it's in the workplace. Why wouldn't it be? So psychoanalysis brings all of that, and I think very much the use of group theory, Bion, what happens, how groups can ordinarily go rather mad, and what can be done about that. So that's all the psychoanalytic thing, really thinking about yourself, taking responsibility for your contribution to what's going on, thinking about your own buttons and how they might get pressed and your tendency to try and press other people's in nice and not at all nice ways. All of those things I find incredibly helpful. And I find that my clients find them incredibly helpful as well. And then the systems bit, part of that is thinking about the breadth, really, that something that happens in one place has reverberations all over the place, like the butterfly theory.
Mm-hmm.
That is right, it is butterfly theory, isn't it?
Yeah.
Butterfly bats, it's whatever a butterfly does. And it's felt all over the planet. I might have slightly exaggerated that. I think you know what I mean.
Yes, yeah.
But also in systems theory, I find it really helpful to think about the idea of representation that family systemic therapy uses. Like, what does one person represent for a family? And I think in an organisation, that can be so helpful. So rather than thinking about, you know, this person is an absolute pain in the arse, thinking about what might this person be representing. I'm not saying they may be a pain in the arse. And I think that's one of the things we have to do is try and work out what's individual and what's systemic and what's both. So they may also be representing something for the whole system, for the organization, for its wider context. And if you only deal with them as an individual, you're missing a whole heap.
That's very important. It's one of the dangers of executive coaching, actually. I mean, I am a coach and I love coaching, but it is one of the dangers you can kind of outsource the person who's the problem or the star of the team to an external coach and not deal with it systemically as a whole. I think it's one of the huge kind of areas coaching needs to address.
I totally agree. And I also worry sometimes that as a coach, I also do coaching as well as work with organisations and teams. And I worry at times, you know, what am I not seeing? I'm not sure how much we're able to see of the whole system when we work just with an individual. We can try. I certainly do try, but and sometimes I worry that I'm really not.
Yeah. Well, there's bound to be limits. I mean, I think one of the great strengths of psychoanalysis and systems when they come together is both these two kind of theories, these methods, these frameworks, they both have a very strong both and. It's like psychoanalysis doesn't say it's conscious or it's unconscious. It's conscious and it's unconscious. We're doubly subjected. So people have an awareness and there's an unawareness. And this happens in individuals and in groups. And what you said about systems kind of made me think again about that, how somebody can be a pain in the ass in the team. Yeah, they do have personal kind of issues and they can be a systemic problem as well. And if you get rid of that person, then the problem shows up in another person or in another way because it's the underlying structure and the underlying system which hasn't been dealt with.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the thing that you said about conscious and unconscious, I absolutely agree. And sometimes we think we're aware and we have some awareness, but there might be a whole other layer that we're unaware of. But also I think sometimes, certainly my experience of my own analysis was that there were parts of myself that I was completely unaware of.
Yes, yeah.
That were only unconscious until the analytic process made it more, brought some of it into consciousness.
Yeah, I mean, I've been in and out of analysis for many years, many, many, many years. And, you know, I've started again with a Lacanian analyst and I guess I've been going for 3 months. I'm kind of blown away by how much, when I lie on the couch, how much kind of just stuff is there, how much kind of memories, how much material. It's just there, like, you know, and because in our busy lives, our everyday lives, we don't access it and it does come out unconsciously, kind of we act out. But when you stop and when you kind of free associate and just kind of allow the unconscious to speak, it's amazing just how much is there.
Yeah, how rich it is.
Yeah, yeah.
And it can be joyful and it can be painful and alarming and everything in between.
Yeah, and that work of free association is I think it's vital in, I don't think enough coaches do this either or consultants. I think bringing that frame of not necessarily trying to solve a problem or overcome a challenge or make the team a great high performance team, but just allowing that space to free associate, just allowing things to bubble to the surface, just what rich material can come from that alone.
Yeah. And it can be incredibly helpful for the client that they might not come to a solution, but they might find that their thinking changes in different ways because of that richness, because what can just appear to them.
Yeah. I mean, I think the approach is it's like learning through transmission. It's very much about not there just to solve problems, but it is about a way of being, a different way of listening, a different way of listening to yourself, a different way of listening to others with this systemic and this psychoanalytic perspective.
It's a different way of paying attention, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
We attend to things that on a daily basis often get really aren't attended to.
No. And we have, and when you start doing that, you become aware of patterns. This is again how psychoanalysis and systems thinking overlaps. You know, you start seeing patterns in yourself, patterns, repetitions of behaviors in teams. And this kind of tells us a lot, you know, how many teams, how many organizations get stuck at the same place over and over.
Yeah.
Without recognizing it, and they take the same path to try and solve it, and then it happens again. And you need to look and listen in a different way. Can you say something about, you said something earlier, and I think it'd be helpful for people to dig a bit deeper. You said using yourself as an instrument, and it's a phrase we use quite often. Can you say a bit more about that?
Well, let me try and give a concrete example. So thinking about one that comes to mind is with a team quite recently. I started to feel they were fine, and somebody was saying something about something that had been a tiny bit difficult, but it was fine. And I started to feel more and more anxious, and I'd felt okay, but I got more and more anxious, like my stomach was in knots. I was physically feeling anxious, and I didn't know what it was about. And in the end, what I did was listen to it, though. I attended to the increasing anxiety that I felt. And in the end, I said that I wondered whether that thing that had been mentioned, that was a tiny bit problematic but was fine, maybe it wasn't as fine as all that. Mm-hmm. Maybe there was some anxiety around it. So I really used my physical feeling of growing anxiety and that knotted stomach, I really used it as an instrument to try and work out what might be going on. And I didn't know whether I was right. I might not have been right. But I had enough of a feeling within me to at least put something out in the room.
Yeah.
And it turned out that actually the person that had mentioned it, it was a huge thing. Mm. It was a huge thing. And it had been pushed away, and then we were able to think about the pain that was involved in it, the reason for pushing it away, the reason other people didn't pick it up, all of those things.
Yeah. So for a non-psychoanalytic audience, it's there's different words for this. We talk about projection or countertransference, but I mean, the idea is that you feel, you pay attention to your own body and to your own feelings and your own emotions, and try and separate kind of what's yours. So if you come into the meeting very anxious anyway because your children are sick or something, then you acknowledge your own stuff. Yeah. But when you sit there and you make yourself available and you become a container for the emotions of the group, then you can start reading your emotions as part of this wider system, as part of something coming from the group, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's what you just shared, which is very important.
And I think it is really important to recognise when it's our stuff. I mean, I did something that is unusual recently, where I was in a group. We were all sitting close together, and then it turned out that three people were off with COVID. And I am vulnerable. I'm in that group of vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And I felt my anxiety go through the roof when I realized three were off with COVID. We were in the room close together, no air, no windows opened. And what I decided to do was, because I thought, I can't work like this. I'm too anxious.
Yeah.
So I actually interrupted the flow of what was going on and said to them, I actually am vulnerable, and I realise I've got very anxious when this has been mentioned. Mm-hmm. Can we open the windows, please?
Yeah.
And they were so good about it. They were slightly shocked and said, do you want us to sit further away? Do you want more windows? Should we open the door? You know?
Yeah, yeah.
No, no, it's fine. And then I could contain myself.
Yeah.
Because otherwise I couldn't manage myself. And that was the main thing. I knew I wouldn't be able to manage myself. I wouldn't be able to work. But also, I think there was a risk then of me dumping my anxiety onto them.
Yeah, yeah.
So actually, it was unusual for me to say that and to interrupt them. But I think it was okay.
I think it's very important, because I think, like, pretending we're super strong or super neutral or you know, yeah, like a non-human person, it's like a, not very helpful. I did something similar. I was doing some work for the Church of England, and I was stood in front of 40 priests, vicars, from across the country, from all different traditions, all different parts of the church. And I suddenly felt really anxious. And I actually quite like public speaking. I'm you know, it's something I've got used to, and I kind of enjoy the engagement. But this time it was like, what's going on?
Yeah.
And I felt the same. I thought, well, I can either just pretend it's not there, or I can say, you know, this is happening. And so I shared it with the group. And what's really interesting is, one, we kind of had a dialogue about what it might mean. And actually to be in front of 30 or 40 priests is quite intimidating. Mm-hmm. And it allowed them to start to share about how, you know, how they hide behind their roles, or how mm-hmm. they get so many projections upon them. Mm-hmm. And that my response was not uncommon, actually, that mm-hmm. people are a bit intimidated by priests. And so it opened up a whole kind of, it generated a whole kind of, new understanding for everybody, which we could explore, you know, from my own personal kind of experience, which I owned.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it got you straight into the work in a very rich way, didn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. We dove straight in. It was like, you know, it just opened everyone up, because before then it was like, who's this kind of expert on leadership and who are they, you know? So it just cut through all that. And like, you know, you show some vulnerability, you show some kind of I think if you talk about your emotions and relate it to the group, either like by owning them or saying that maybe the group is feeling anxious as well, just opening that space, it really transforms any group meeting or any dynamic, doesn't it? It does open up a space in a very different way.
Mm. Yeah, it does. I agree.
And it comes from that experience of being on the couch, of that's what we do when we're on the couch, and that's what we that's how we learn about our own emotional lives and our own unconscious lives.
Yes.
And I guess that's part of the work. You know, we do some of that through supervision as sort of coaches and consultants in the workplace, but perhaps not enough. Perhaps we don't do enough of that kind of deeper work on ourselves. I think the psychoanalytic community does, but I think beyond that, I think there's still work to be done to educate people about how important our emotional lives are to the work we do.
I think some of my most challenging consultancy work over the years, I was going to say the most important help on it from my analyst rather than, and that's not true in a way. It doesn't mean I haven't got incredibly important help from supervision, but I've got differently extremely important help from my analyst that an individual or peer supervision couldn't give me, because they're not analysing me and they don't know me like the analyst does. But the analyst, without ever becoming a supervisor, knows exactly and can go straight to the spot mm-hmm. that they recognise as being touched in you or in me.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's right. And I mean, another thing I noticed is I've run quite a few peer supervision groups, and people, very experienced coaches and consultants. And it's quite interesting, coming with a psychoanalytic lens, what a different perspective you can bring to that group. You know, they can mm-hmm. be super experienced. They work with very senior leaders, very skilled at what they do. But there's something else you bring as a with that sort of psychoanalytic lens, which you describe so beautifully in your book. Yeah. Mm. One thing I've been struggling with since studying at the Tavistock, we both did the same master's degree. I did that way back in the day as well. One thing I came away with from the Tavistock and the Klein and object relations tradition and the group relations tradition is that for me, it leans too much into pathologizing, too much into the defenses. And I began to get interested in Lacan's work, because he spoke of enjoyment, jouissance, desire, not as some sort of positive psychology, but just as a way of exploring it. And I think, like Freud's early work, you know, he was interested in desire as well, and libido, and they weren't words used very much during the training, libido, desire. And I wonder what your thoughts are about kind of how psychoanalysis kind of works across those boundaries of libido and drive, as well as looking at the defences and the shadow side?
I think psychoanalysis can and does in some orientations more than others. I'm not sure how much attention we paid to it when we did that, the masters that we both did. It was more the kind of gritty stuff that's really important. But fabulous, we didn't talk about, I mean, in my book, I talk about love, for instance.
Yeah.
And kindness. Well, you can argue that kindness isn't a psychoanalytic concept at all. But the capacity for kindness, and the capacity for love, and of course we did, you know, we did loads on Klein, didn't we? And she connects love and gratitude, of course. But I don't think we particularly talked about love and desire, and I don't necessarily mean sexual desire, but desire in all sorts of different ways that it can be. And I agree with you that I don't think we necessarily pay enough attention to that. I don't agree that psychoanalysis doesn't attend to that.
No.
And certainly, and I had an independent analysis. Mm. And certainly my analyst paid a lot of attention to that.
Yeah.
So I think it does and it can. I'm not sure how good we always are as organisational consultants with that.
Yeah, no, I think it can, and I think clinically and organizationally, I don't think it has spent enough attention on it. I think we offer the world something about the shadow side, the unconscious, which is absolutely vital, because it's not so much of the shadow side is not talked about. It's much easier to talk about the positive stuff. But I think the lens psychoanalysis brings to desire, to libido, to eros, to these drives within us, I think is really important. And it's very different from some positive psychology. It's a very different, you know, so it kind of brings this other way of understanding these unconscious drives within us. And I think you see them in organizational life as much as you see the shadow side. And they're even part of the shadow side. They intermingle, you know, we have kind of our drives and our libidos can get us into trouble, like, you know, our egos as well, you know, and they can be positive forces. But I think psychoanalysis brings something very special to that. And I'd love to see more developmental work done in that area, really.
Yeah. And as you say, there's so much in us and in organisations, of course, because they are us. And I think, and also we think about the grisly part of the unconscious, which is hugely important. And the unconscious can have lots of beauty and love and joy in it as well.
Yeah. Andy, you know, I'm the Ecoleadership Institute is all about ecosystems and trying to understand humans within a wider context, in our wider sort of ecologies. And I think, you know, that understanding the unconscious is not just something deep and dark within us, but something actually which is between us, which is relational and relational with nature. You know, our experience of nature, our conscious and our unconscious engagement, the more work I do in that area, it's just very, very interesting how we as humans respond to nature once we open ourselves up to it. It's a very I think the unconscious is very interesting in how humans collectively kind of respond to the world around them, the context around them, in small groups, in large groups, within natural groups. I think it's an interesting field to explore.
One of the things that I think we get very fearful of, and I think it is very problematic, is how do we deal with some of, I mean, I'm so aware of what a difficult time in the world we're at the moment. Mm. And how do we deal with that in organisational life? Because I think also people in organisations are often very nervous about what can they say, what can't they say, what will trigger, as it were, a bomb reaction in some of the current conflicts that are going on that are so loud in all over the world, and certainly in the UK. They might not be in the UK, but what's happening in Israel-Palestine is loud in the UK. People are very anxious about what can they say, what can't they say, what will happen if they say something. And I think we maybe sidestep that as well as consultants, really, and need to think more about what we do about that.
Yeah, I agree with you. And it's like the culture wars have made it very challenging as well. So it's like, you know, Israel and Palestine is a very clear kind of example. But gender as well, how we, you know, what can you say about gender and what can't you say? And all these issues are very alive, and finding a way to talk about them is really important. And we live in troubled times. I think people do stutter or they become silent over so many issues.
That's a really good way of putting it. They either stutter or get silent. I think that's a really good way of putting it. Or they might throw a bomb.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not stuttering, and that's not great either. No. They might throw it because they might be propelled to by the group as well to throw a bomb. But it's really complicated and difficult.
It is. And, you know, we talk about free associations and you know, I go into organizations and I do a free association matrix, which is, for those who know social dream matrix, I've adapted it. So you don't just associate to your dreams. You can associate to whatever's in your body or in the work, you know, and I've used it for many years. And I'm noticing that now people are less able to do it because people are more wary of free associations and more wary of crossing a boundary, which might upset somebody in the room, you know? So it's, yeah, I think it's, it is interesting and troubling.
Yeah. Yeah. And also it's, you know, what do we bring of our own selves in that?
Mm.
And that's another whole layer of complexity.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean the work around your own attachments and investments. You know, what are you attached to, and you know what triggers you, and what are you invested in, and these questions are really, really important, I think. And if we can't do it as coaches and consultants, we can't expect the leaders and the organizations to do it either. So we have to kind of try and open up that space, don't we?
Yeah, I know. I mean, when I was writing the book, I actually found that I put in far more of myself than I expected to, far more than I would talk to clients about. And at one point I thought I might not be able to work anymore or not do the kind of work that I've been doing because I'm so exposed now. I've said so much.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's what the book needs, and I'll have to make a decision, but I'm doing it for the book. And I decided it was all right, actually. Yeah. It was all right. And it's an and, not a but. Interestingly, clients who have come to me having read the book have a different reaction. Partly they expect to go quick, deep, because I've read the book. But also, like, now they know my background. And I've had a couple of ex-clients get in touch and say, are you all right? Thinking about you, what's going, you know, how this must be for you, which they wouldn't normally know anything like that about me. And then I'm also faced with, well, what do I say? Because where I sit on an issue might not be quite what they would expect. It's all very complicated.
No, I understand. I mean, I've shifted the dial quite a bit. I use myself because I think organizations need humanizing, and because I think, you know, I think we have to bring our human selves to the work. But it is complicated. Before, in my books, I always write the first chapter, what authored the author. And it's a partial story of myself. It's not a full story. I leave out, you know, loads of stuff, but even with that partial story, it's you know, you're opening up a space and you're sharing a lot of stuff. And on Substack essays, I write and I bring the personal in thoughtfully. I don't bring it in just to check it out there. You know, it's thoughtfully, and I'm aware that I'm a professional in a field. but it's there. But it is a balancing act, yeah, and trying to trying to get it right is a challenge.
Yeah. And then, I mean, generally, I found clients are incredibly sensitive and respectful and contained in terms of what they'll say to me and what they'll ask me and what they won't ask me from what's in the book. But it is out there. It is in the book.
Yeah, yeah.
And I obviously have to be open to that and what comes from that.
Yeah, I think there used to be when I did my early days training as a person-centered counselor, was the first masters I did in Keele University, and it was this sort of non-positive regard, and you had to kind of have this sort of neutrality about yourself. You're non-judgmental. Which means you couldn't, you wouldn't do an interpretation, or you wouldn't kind of step into a space. And I always found I could understand where Rogers came from, and I think he moved the field a lot in the '50s. I think he did some very good work to open up sort of therapy to a much wider audience. It went into schools and things, but I do think it was a problematic where, like, psychoanalysts used to be a neutral kind of voice sat behind the couch in silence, a very dehumanized kind of position, really, and I think there is a move to try and bring the humanity back into it. I mean, I did a podcast a few years back now with Gianpiero Patrigelli, and he he brings love into his work a lot. He takes a psychoanalytic stance, but also brings love and him and his wife, they're writing about their relationships, which is interesting, and bringing that into the public sphere. So you can see, I think people are realizing there's a real absolute need to humanize a workplace, particularly in a sort of a digital age.
And then we have to keep thinking. I suppose I often think about working at the boundary, so you're not saying there's a boundary out there and I always stay on the right side of it. It's sort of going up to it and constantly thinking about what is it and what is keeping within the boundary and what is overstepping the boundary. So it's never easy. It's constantly rethinking it and looking at it and questioning myself.
Yeah, and it's contextual. So when I'm talking to... I was invited to Rome to do some work with the Catholic Church, with the Jesuits on leadership, and that audience is very different to working. I was working in a huge car manufacturer, so these are very different contexts. A hospital is a very different context. Really being aware of the cultural context, and we often talk about cultures and gender, but actually, workplaces have their own cultures. I don't think we spend enough time to think about, what's the difference between a hospital and a car manufacturer.
Yeah, they're hugely different. Hugely different. And as consultants, we step in and we have to try and get the culture very quickly, don't we?
In order
to be able to work with them.
Yeah, which is one of the joys I find. I mean, I think I'm a wannabe anthropologist, really, because I just love going into organizations and just kind of experiencing the culture and feeling it. One of the delights about our work, I don't know if you feel the same, is that just going to so many diverse organizations and meeting so many diverse people, it's a real privilege, I think, to get that kind of those insights into kind of people's lives in different spaces and places.
Yeah, I agree. And there's an upside as well to some of the stuff in our personal lives. Like if I have builders or something, I can get frustrated as anybody at what the hell's going on or not going on. But also I get very curious about how they work as a team, what seems to hold them together, what doesn't hold them together, where the authority lies, how the authority's used, all of that. It brings a whole other level to how you're interacting. How you're going through the process, not necessarily how you're interacting at all. Yeah. It might not change that at all, but I think it changes how you think about the process.
Yeah, no, it creates a whole level of a different level of interest. Like I find it hard to go into a restaurant without kind of looking at how the team's working together and the vibe. You know, you get this kind of feel, this sense of, is it a bullying restaurant? Is it a kind of loving restaurant? Is it, you know, what's happening there? Who's the boss? Who's leading this game? Yeah. It's a lot of fun, actually. If you get, and that's the other thing we don't talk about enough, is the playfulness of this work. You like to be creative and to think with others around how they're working dynamically. You have to have a kind of a curiosity and playfulness, don't you?
Yeah. And play is so important and so helpful. And to encourage that feeling of just being curious and playful in teams, I think that's incredibly helpful.
Yeah, massively important. Gabriella, we're coming towards the end and I'm going to ask you to be playful now. I end with two questions about what your thoughts are on what it means to live a good life and to create a good society. So have you got any playful thoughts around those issues?
What it means to lead a good life and to create a good society.
Yeah, big questions.
Huge questions. Okay, so to lead a good life, I think, is something about trying to, I'm going to try and say this in a non-stereotyping way, but something about living as best we can with our qualities and our disabilities, I mean that in the broadest sense, but knowing them and living as best we can. So not running from them, not trying to accommodate ourselves and do the things that give us pleasure and are also contributing to society. For me, that's a good life. That's important. But also the things that are, you know, so there'll be downsides, there'll be good sides, there'll be love, there'll be pain. So allowing the different parts of us to be together. So not working all the time, but also playing at work. So things get mixed around. My work now, a lot of my work now is writing, which I love. So I feel I'm living a good life in terms of being able to do what I really want to do. So there's something about that. But also I try and pay attention to the bits of me I'm ignoring or the bits where I'm out of balance and try and do something about that. That's something about living a good life. Did that make
lovely,
sense?
Lovely, lovely.
And contribute, helping create a good society. Oh, well, oh God, how can I say this without going on a soapbox? I'm not going on the soapbox. I'm currently trying to write a novel, and to me it is all about contributing to trying to help in a tiny bit. I know it's tiny bit, trying to contribute to something a bit better in society. But it's the way that I can contribute, and it matters enormously to me. So I'm trying to do it. And I'm doing it also by talking to loads of people. I'm doing research. I'm talking to people I wouldn't normally talk to. I'm talking to people who are very different. That's part of it. And that, to me, increases my understanding of otherness and difference, and maybe helps reduce conflict a tiny bit.
Yeah. Well, I hope this podcast has added a tiny bit with our contributions and our sharing. It's been a really pleasure to have you, Gabriella. Oh, thank you so much for sharing everything.
It's been a great pleasure to talk with you, Simon. Thank you.
Take care. Bye now.
Bye.